From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet classical violinist Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. Her emotional and aggressive way of playing, as well as her unconventional attire on stage, earned her a reputation as the violin's bad girl. 5 years ago, her career almost ended after she nearly chopped the tip of her finger off. She tells us about the accident and how she renewed her passion for music. She's the subject of a new documentary, Speaking in Strings. And Ken Tucker reviews Fly, the new CD by the Dixie Chicks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Pentagon officials are attacking a congressional proposal to cut the budgets of all federal agencies. Among other things, officials say the plan could force thousands of soldiers to lose their jobs, NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Pentagon officials are trying to show that a seemingly modest budget cut would actually produce a disaster. The Republican majority in Congress faces a problem. Their budget figures don't add up, so they propose simply cutting the spending of nearly all federal agencies by 1.4%. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Hugh Shelton, says the cut would be devastating. A Pentagon spokesman says it would force the military to reduce its strength by up to 70,000 people, either by firing soldiers or slowing down recruitment. Pentagon officials also insist the cut would affect programs to buy new weapons. Overall, the cut would reduce the biggest defense budget in years, one that Republicans and Democrats just voted to increase. Republicans who support the budget cut say the Pentagon and other agencies can easily come up with the money by eliminating what they call waste, fraud, and abuse. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Federal safety investigators spent the day in South Dakota searching the wreckage of the Learjet in which golf champion Payne Stewart and five others died. Robert Francis, vice chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, said the plane was nearly vertical when it hit the soft ground of a cow pasture and it went about 10 feet into the ground. He said the wreckage will have to be removed carefully to avoid destroying evidence. The plane was on a flight from Orlando, Florida, to Dallas, Texas, when the pilots apparently lost control and it strayed off course. There's speculation that the plane lost cabin pressure, depriving the people aboard of oxygen. The head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency is urging people in North Carolina to be patient as the government helps them recover from Hurricane Floyd. Last month's storm destroyed more than 15,000 homes. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
FEMA Director James Lee Witt says the recovery is well underway in flood-damaged North Carolina. Speaking to a group of mayors and local officials, Witt said FEMA has received 67,000 applications for government aid and has handed out $38 million. 5 weeks after the storm, some victims are complaining that aid isn't coming quickly enough, but Witt says the agency is doing all it can to help.
In a disaster of this magnitude, people go through shock, they go through frustration, and then sometimes they'll get just mad as all get out. But one thing that destroys communities and everything is when people start putting blame on someone else that's trying to help them.
FEMA says computer problems over the weekend delayed the agency from inspecting flood-damaged homes, but Witt says even with the delay, 90% of the inspections are complete. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Raleigh, North Carolina.
The Dow lost 48 points to close at 10,302. This is NPR. Federal weather experts are predicting a tough winter for much of the northern part of the country. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says the Pacific Northwest will experience above-normal snowfall and storms. The report said the Great Lakes region and the Northeast could also get above-normal snow, but said the weather's likely to vary a lot from week to week. NOAA predicts warmer and drier than normal temperatures for the South and Southwest. The Atlanta Braves are hoping to begin a comeback tonight in New York in Game 3 of baseball's World Series. The Braves lost the first two games at home. NPR's Melissa Block reports from Yankee Stadium.
The much-heralded Atlanta pitching staff has been ineffective against the Yankee bats, and the Braves' hitting has been anemic in the face of stellar Yankee pitching. The Braves went hitless in the first seven innings of Games 1 and 2. Tom Glavine will be pitching tonight for Atlanta after a bout with the flu knocked him out of the lineup. Andy Pettit starts for the Yankees. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan throws out the ceremonial first pitch, and a trained bald eagle named Challenger will swoop down onto the field at the end of the national anthem. The reigning world champion Yankees are hoping for their 25th championship crown, and the odds are in their favor. Three-quarters of the teams who've taken a 2-0 lead in the series have gone on to win the championship. Melissa Block, NPR News at Yankee Stadium.
American consumers were less optimistic about the economy in October. The Conference Board said its index of consumer confidence fell by more than 4 points to 130.1. It was the fourth monthly drop in a row. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. My guest is violinist Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. Since winning one of classical music's most prestigious competitions, the Naumburg Prize, when she was only 19, Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg has been the celebrated and reviled bad girl of the violin. She's the subject of a new documentary called Speaking in Strings. Critics call her intensely physical and passionate performing style overwrought and affected. Meanwhile, audiences flock to her concerts. From Speaking in Strings, here she is playing and talking about the Sibelius Concerto.
He writes it on the lowest, on the G string. he writes it on the G string so that when you get up to here, you see the sound is so strained because it's unnatural. Where it'd be easier to go, but it's not the same desperate feeling. It's unnatural to play that high on the G string.
Huh.
But he wants that kind of sound, you know?
Torture.
Torture, exactly. Torturously romantic.
Speaking in Strings, which was directed by her childhood friend Paolo De Florio, chronicles Sonnenberg's childhood, growing up in a family of musicians, and difficult times, both personal and professional. 5 years ago, at a time when Sonnenberg was questioning her commitment to performing, she accidentally severed the tip of her left pinky finger. I asked her how it happened.
Well, it was Christmas Day, and I had quite a bunch of people over my place, and I was preparing dinner. And I think there was a game on, and the stereo was on, and we had some Christmas carols going, and, you know, it was quite noisy, and people running around and laughing and this and that. And I was in the kitchen, and it's simply that. I was slicing onions and got down to the, you know, when there's hardly any onion left, and you turn it over, and I sliced through. And, I mean, thankfully, the knife was extremely sharp. So it was a clean slice, and that's how I took the tip off of my pinky finger. It was an amazing moment that sort of time stopped, and I just looked at it and realized that my life would never be the same.
Did you go into shock?
Yeah, I think it was the only time in my life where I guess you could call it shock. I suppose it lost it is a phrase that comes to mind. I had no physical control of my body. I think because the impact of it was so, it wasn't just an accident where you see blood. It was my finger, and So in 1 second, which seemed like an hour, I realized that I would never play again. So my whole life changed so drastically that, yeah, I think I went into some kind of shock. And I'm not sure what I did. I'm told I was just pacing up and down the kitchen, yelling, "I'll never play again," and "Who's going to pay the bills?" I was holding my finger, and blood was it was really nasty looking, too. It was everywhere. It was on walls and kind of puddles on the floor. And, you know, at this point, people had come into the kitchen and tried to calm me down. And it was just, I believe it was the only time in my life where I had no control over myself at all.
So your friends got you to the hospital, and it was Christmas, so there were no real doctors there, so
no,
to speak. There were interns, right?
Yeah, luckily my best friend, her father is a doctor, and he was home, and she called him, and he knew the head of blah, 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 and it went on and on. And I'm so fortunate that he was able to make some calls, and luckily people were home. It was a holiday, and I did not have the finger reattached at the hospital because there really was nobody there who could do it. And luckily I wasn't alone there because I would not have been able to make those decisions. At that point I had lost a lot of blood and I was in kind of in shock. So those decisions were made for me, and we went then to a private office in Manhattan, and that doctor flew in from Long Island, and he's a plastic surgeon, and I owe him my life.
What did the doctor tell you your prospects were after the operation, and what did he recommend, that you not play?
Well, of course I couldn't play, no. You have to understand that by the time I saw him, 3.5 hours had passed since I had severed the finger, and a lot of the skin on the rim had died already. Too much time had passed, and because of that, he explained to me that there would be a severe scar tissue problem. Certainly I wasn't, playing was out of the question, but this was too soon to talk about that. However, I do remember him being very sure, very almost egotistical, and being very happy about that. I remember hearing my friend saying who I was, and that she's a great violinist, and he said, "Yes, I'm a great doctor." And I remember feeling very good about that, you know. But I remember hearing that, and I remember him saying, "Yeah, you will play again. You will play again, but you have to listen to me."
During the period that you couldn't play at all, and you were waiting to heal, I would think your mind must play all sorts of games on you when something like that happens, and you're confined. You can't do much. Did you go through that process of blaming yourself? You know, I was thinking about not liking my career anyway, maybe giving it up. So here, I've done something so I have to change
my
life.
Yeah, I went through, I can't begin to tell you what I was thinking during the three-month period that I literally just stayed home every day, all day, had nothing to do, and waited for it to heal somewhat. Naturally, I thought this was a sign from God, as this was, you know, I was thinking about this. Anyhow, it was a decision I probably could never have made. It's very difficult to say, I'm just not going to play anymore. That's it. I quit. I mean, it's in my blood. It's what I do. There's no other way I can make a living, you know, for one thing. But it's so much, when I think back now, I cannot imagine not playing. It would never happen. But I must have been in such a state then. And, of course, this accident happened, and I thought, well, here it is. Here's your sign. Here's your reason to quit. You know that you probably would not have been able to make that decision, so it's been made for you. And then, of course, I thought maybe you did this on purpose in some way, you know, when you weren't thinking and it was the back of your mind. And I cannot imagine that I would do something like that. I'm not afraid to make decisions. So, I mean, my mind went through all kinds of crazy things. And every day reading the New York Times about Newt Gingrich saying this and that about the arts. And it was really a horrible time. I was not very pleasant to be around at that point.
You had a fully booked concert schedule at the time of the accident, and you decided not to wait for the entire period for the finger to heal, but to honor the commitments and to play with three fingers. How does that work? Do you have to completely relearn your repertoire?
Oh, it's awful. I had... my doctor said 17 months. You can't play for 17 months. You know, when he tells you that initially and you're all drugged up anyhow, you know, whatever, you just want to go home and go to bed. But then once you start to snap out of this phase and realize what's happening and realize that you can't do that. I mean, that was not an option for me. So I forced a recovery on it. But before I forced the recovery, I bandaged it up in such a way where it wouldn't get it wouldn't be hurt. It wouldn't even touch the string. And I refingered the repertoire that I had for the rest of that season. So I didn't play the violin for 3 months, and then I went back and played with three fingers for the rest of the season. And then I forced the recovery during the summer. And by September, I was playing with four fingers again. It's awful. It's as if you have to now put your right shoe on your left foot and your left shoe on your right foot and dance. I mean, you know, it's so awkward. Fingerings that you learned when you were very, very young that are so embedded in your mind have to be changed. The concentration level was... I have a very strong ability to concentrate intensely on stage when I need to, which has served me very well. I'm very grateful for that. But it really was tested at this point. And I do remember the very first gig I had coming back with three fingers was New York Philharmonic, which, you know, it's kind of a high pressure gig. So
now, at some point during your recovery, you'd done all this. You'd refingered your repertoire. You'd worked up a callus on your barely healed finger.
That was in the summer following this period. Yeah, I forced a callus.
You were playing concert dates. You had committed to. Yeah, at some point you felt like you couldn't cope, and you attempted suicide. Had you thought about suicide before this time in your life?
No, I hadn't. I never thought about it prior to really the few moments to leading up to it. Certainly not, no. It was also, again, a time when I think, you know, when it rains, it pours. Many, many, many things, because of this accident, because of God knows what, one thing after the next piles up on you, and you find that you can't ignore, run away, or be in denial, or... anymore. And then you have to face a lot of things. And I think this is very natural for a lot of people, which have to be dealt with. And what I was looking at was pretty much a tidal wave of challenge and pain professionally, personally. And I felt at that moment that I couldn't do it. That it was too much. It was way too much. And I knew what it would require. I knew the kind of work. I knew it would take years to heal emotionally and physically. And it would be 24 hours a day of work. And I just, it was a moment of weakness.
You used a gun. Where did you get the gun?
The gun was a gift from a very, very dear friend of mine, who was worried about me because I was living alone and had, I'm sorry to say, quite a few mentally ill fans who were scary and dangerous and threatening. And, you know, you do what you can to protect yourself, but I don't want to live like that when I'm home. You know, if I'm on the road, I had at the time I had protection around me all the time. I don't like living like that. And he was so worried about me that he bought me this little gun, very little, actually beautiful little feminine gun, and said, "Please keep it in your bed table. You just have no idea what could happen, and you know, I don't want anything to happen to you, just in case." I mean, it was a total. I had the gun for over 6 years, sitting there in the bed table, so little that it was in the back of the drawer. I completely forgot it was there until that day.
You were upset. You called a friend because you were distraught. She came over to your apartment and hid the gun from you. And then stepped out of the room, and you went and found the gun that she had hidden. Mm-hmm. Had you already made your decision to act about what you were going to do at that point?
I think I have to preface it by saying that I was not thinking clearly. And I think that entire... I remember that it was in the afternoon, and I remember that I had gotten up that morning and went out and did some chores, things that I had to do. And by the time I got home, and I'll tell you something very funny, which I think was made me snap. The OJ trial had finished, and they announced the verdict. And I snapped. I don't know what happened. I mean, that was... that has nothing to do with my life, you know, but it was a decision which to me seemed unjust. And it was a catalyst for thinking of all the unjust factors in my life. And that's when I started to rant and rave. And I called her, and I apparently couldn't make sense of what I was saying. So she came over to the apartment. Yeah.
You found your gun, and you pulled a trigger, held it to your head, and mm-hmm. pulled a trigger, and the gun jammed.
Yep. It jammed. It didn't work. I couldn't even do that. It didn't work, and next thing I knew, it was the next day.
When you woke up, do you go somewhere different after you've attempted suicide? I don't know how else to ask that question. Do you get beyond you pass through some door or jump over a wall? Are you in a different place?
You are in a different place, although you don't know why. You're not necessarily a better place. You are very tender. Your emotions are very tender. And it's like, you know, when you're sick and you're weak, you're very weak. So for you to get up and even to go to the kitchen and make yourself some soup is so hard to do because you're so weak. And you are very weak emotionally. Very, very weak. It didn't, you know, my life hadn't changed at all. Everything that was upsetting to me the day before was still there, but it was somehow, and I cannot explain it, that was not an option anymore. Plus which, the people in my life, my friends and loved ones and family would not allow that to happen again. So I was never alone for a long time after that.
My guest is violinist Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg. She is one of the world's preeminent soloists. She's the subject of a new documentary called Speaking in Strings by director Paolo Di Florio, who's a childhood friend of Sonnenberg's. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg. She's an internationally celebrated violinist. She's also the subject of a new documentary film about a difficult period in her life called Speaking in Strings. You played a concert at Carnegie Hall 2 weeks after this suicide attempt. What was your rationale going into the concert, and did you ever consider canceling?
I wanted to play the concert. I knew that since that was not an option again, ever again, that my only therapy would be my violin. I knew that clear as day. So I wanted to play the concert. I was not in good physical shape. I hadn't practiced for a while. And, you know, emotionally I wasn't too good either, but I had made up my mind to play the concert. And this reminded me very much of a time in my life when I was much younger, what I was thinking when I entered the Naumburg competition. And I had set a goal for myself because I was floundering at that time as well. I didn't know if I wanted to play the violin and lots of things like that. I was 19 years old.
And that was the concert that made your reputation.
Well, that was the competition. I won that competition. I had set a goal for myself. If I could make the finals of Naumburg, then that would prove to me that I was good enough to continue. That very simply, I was good enough to continue playing the violin, studying the violin, this craft. being a part of this craft. I want it. I still don't know how, but I want it. So I at this time, for this particular concert in Carnegie Hall, I thought, if I can get through this concert, this particular piece, there is no more pressure gig than Carnegie Hall. It just doesn't exist. With this concerto, then I'm going to be fine. I'm going to make it. It'll probably take a long time, may take years, but I will survive, and I will survive. I will come through this time in my life better, stronger and better and wiser and calmer. And I knew it. I just knew that instinctively. So I wanted to play the concert, but I had no idea if I could play it. That was the scary part.
What music did you play in your Carnegie Hall concert? Did it have significance for you?
I played the Shostakovich Violin Concerto No. 1, which, yes, has a lot of significance. It's a piece that is, I think I play very well. I've always felt close to it. I heard it. It's a piece that represents a battle to me, however. I remember hearing it long time ago on the radio, being blown away by it and going to my teacher and saying, I want to learn it. And she didn't think it was a good idea, so she wouldn't teach it to me. There were other pieces that she thought I should be learning at that time, and she was right. But I was really taken by this piece, and I wanted to play it. So it was a battle to learn it because I had to learn it on my own, and nobody would teach it to me. And it's kind of a battle just getting through it. It's very physical. It's very long. It's a profoundly wonderful piece. And in many ways, and it runs the gamut of emotions from A to Z, and technically very challenging. And endurance-wise, it's very challenging. So it was the perfect piece to play at that concert. It represented a lot, I think.
Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. We'll hear more from her in the second half of our show. Let's listen to her playing Shostakovich. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Crown, publishers of the novella by novelist Stephen Milhauser, Enchanted Night, a tale imbued with the power of the moon. Available in bookstores. From BET on Jazz, premiering Future Wave on October 25th with host Herbie Hancock. Information 877-733-5299. And from the Modern Library, publishers of The Cost of Living, the new book by Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the Dixie Chicks. And we continue our conversation with violinist Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. She grew up in a house filled with music and shared a love of Italian opera with her grandfather.
I said, I want to touch the earth. I want to break it in my hands. I want to grow something wild and unruly. I want to sleep on the hard ground in the comfort of your arms, on a pillow of blue bonnets, in a blanket made of stars. Oh, it sounds good to me. I said, cowboy, take me away. Fly this girl as high as you can into the wild blue. Set those are the heaven above and
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. She's the subject of a new documentary, Speaking in Strings. She grew up in a family of musicians. They moved to the U.S. from Italy when she was 8. You've often said that your musical inspiration comes from opera, that your passion for music comes from opera. And I know your grandfather loved the opera. Did you listen to it with him?
Every Saturday we listened to Texaco Presents Live from the Met, every Saturday. And he explained every single thing that was happening at the opera, not just a little synopsis. I mean, every single thing. And he explained about singing to me the differences of the voices, the interpretations. I learned an awful lot about opera from my grandfather. And I find myself now, when I'm working on a piece, interpretively, I play the way I would sing it if I could sing it. I play very much like a singer.
What does that mean, to have a singer's approach to your instrument?
I think it means a very natural approach, as it's the most natural instrument there is, the voice. I think that a phrase has a beginning, a development, a peak, and an end. And singers have to, good singers, have to find a way to execute that within their breath. We have a bow, but still a bow, which you would think doesn't run out. Not necessarily, because you can hear a bow change, a down bow to an up bow. You can hear a bow change, which can cut into a phrase. So it just was a natural way for me to hear music, because I had only listened to singers. I listened to Heifetz when I was young, because my mother had a lot of Heifetz records. And I listened to Heifetz and I listened to opera. So I grew up with an influence of extreme individuality, which I think he's the only violinist where you can hear two notes and you know it's him, which I have to say does not exist today at all. And the opera influence of voices and how they use their voice and how they phrased and the drama of opera. So that's you know, made me the musician I am today. Whether it's good or bad is irrelevant. That's what I grew up with.
In the film Speaking in Strings, you talk about Rachmaninoff's Vocalise, how you listen to this with your grandfather in his room in your house, and mm-hmm. how there's a part of the opera where you couldn't believe that the singer completed a line all in one breath, that you'd ask your grandfather, is this possible? Mm-hmm. Right. I'd like to play your rendition of the last passage of Vocalise from the CD of the music from the documentary. And maybe you could talk about what you're trying to express with the violin that you appreciate in the opera.
It is a tune called Vocalise, and it's sung by Anna Moffo, and I think it's a historic recording. It's the last phrase of the piece, which encompasses, it kind of wraps up the whole piece. It's an extremely sad work, and I was amazed at the fact that she did it in one breath. I think she did it in one breath. It certainly sounds like she did it in one breath, and the control of that, and to hear a phrase, the beginning and the development and the peak and the ending of a phrase in one breath. I hate to say this, but it takes your breath away. And I was shocked by it. And it made a huge impression, and I tried to emulate it. And what's amazing is that I couldn't. I tried. I came close, and I try every time I play it. But even I have a bow that doesn't end, that down bow and up bow, to have that seamless phrase without any jarring at all, a breath or another bow, is practically impossible. It just made a very huge impression on me.
Let's listen. This is Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg playing Rachmaninoff's Vocalise from her new recording, Speaking in Strings, music from the documentary about Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg.
Thank you.
have a storyline in mind to a piece of music, even when it's not opera?
You know, I not always, but very, very, very often. And there were certain pieces that I learned as a student. I wanted to learn them. I was very affected by them. I didn't know how to understand the piece. And Dorothy DeLay, my teacher, knew this about me. She knew that I was a very, very visual person. And I am extremely visual in the way I think. I see the problems and I literally see the solution. And she started helping me to create storylines for certain pieces so that I could understand them. And I remember specifically working on the Prokofiev F minor sonata with her. And I heard the piece, I loved it, and I got the music and I learned the notes best I could at that point, and I still couldn't play it the way I had originally heard it. And I did a harmonic analysis and melodic analysis. I did all the technical analysis, bow strokes, this and that, and I still couldn't grasp it. And she sat down with me and she said, what do you hear when you hear this? What do you think? What kind of music? If you were listening to this and you were looking at a screen, what would you see? And I made up this whole story. And I did this a few times with her, and it proved very helpful to me when I was young. It really did.
What does the story do for you then? How does it feed back into the music?
Well, it explains the music in a visual way. So for that particular piece, my story was, it focused on a war. The actual war, the aftermath of the war, what could have happened, what would have been if the war had not happened. And I think it's perfect for that sonata. Perfect. Then when I needed to play the piece, and, you know, you have to understand when you're learning it and you play it a few times, you perform it a few times, it starts to get into your blood and into your system and it becomes something that is familiar to you. You don't have to constantly go back to that story every time you play it. But the story fits so well, that particular piece, that I always think of this war and this town, decimated city, when I play that piece.
You've said that you go into a kind of hypnosis or kind of trance when you're playing, and that's one reason you're not aware of what your body's doing and the swaying motion or what's going on with your face. Mm-hmm. Is that what athletes... something like what athletes talk about when they talk about going into the zone, and it's something that only happens when you're really hitting your mark, when you're really on top.
Well, we're talking about two different things. Going into the zone, playing in the zone is a treat. Doesn't happen very often. The kind of concentration that is needed when you're on stage, even if you're not playing in the zone, those are very special concerts, you know, when everything is going well, and it feels good as well. You still, there's a severe level of concentration on stage, and that is what takes over my mind when I'm playing. And I am not aware of a lot of other things that are happening. There are a lot of distractions that happen in a concert, in the hall, people coughing, and there are many things that you don't want to have effect, don't want to let them into your performance, because you need to be there. There are so many things to think about, so many things to concentrate on, and that is why I'm not aware of physical movements or things that to me I find perfectly they're silly. That why should I think about my feet when I have this passage of tenths to play here? I mean I have other things to think about when I'm playing.
My guest is violinist Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is violinist Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. You came out with a CD last year, Humoresque. It's music inspired by the music of the 1947 Hollywood film. And there's a rendition of Embraceable You on it that is just really enjoyable.
Isn't it? It's wonderful. It's so much fun to play, too.
It's so tender and playful. You play it very playfully. You play around with the tempos. When you're interpreting a jazz standard like that, do you go through a process of declassicalizing your play, your style?
No, I don't. I don't have to. It's very funny. Jazz, you know, I'm not a jazz violinist. And I would not pretend to be a jazz violinist, and I would never make a jazz recording as some classical violinists I know have. It's just that is a completely different art form, which is challenging, and I would have to devote my life to it in order to be even decent at it. However, having said that, playing a Cole Porter tune or a Gershwin tune is not necessarily playing jazz, especially when it's written out. It is about style, and I find it as easy to do that, to switch styles and to play that style completely in that style with that kind of music as I do with classical music. I mean, it's very different to play a Prokofiev sonata and then play the Mozart Adagio. We're talking about as different kind of music as jazz is to classical. It's all music. It's all notes. It's the same notes. I don't have to... I have never had to program myself one way or another to play a piece of music. If you play a recital, the recitals that I play, I like to inject them with a variety of music. Not all one composer, not all one style, unless there's a reason for that. So therefore, you walk on stage and you will start with a Beethoven sonata, and then you'll play a Poulenc sonata, and then maybe you play a Strauss sonata. And we're talking about very, very, very different styles of music. And there's never been a problem adjusting to that. So there was no problem playing this piece at all.
Let's play a bit of Embraceable You from your new recording, Humoresque, music from the 1947 Warner Brothers film. And this is my guest, Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. You write in the liner notes to this CD, Humoresque, that your mother introduced you to the 1947 film, which is pretty sophisticated stuff. It stars Joan Crawford. It takes place during the Depression. It's about a young genius violinist played by John Garfield, and Joan Crawford is his patron and his mistress and an alcoholic, and Oscar Levant has a part. He's a cynical piano-playing friend, or maybe he's a bit more than
imagine
a friend.
Imagine that.
It's really pretty racy. Mm-hmm. What was your mother thinking?
You know, my mother used to do stuff like that. First opera she took me to was Salome. You know, people were yelling at her, like, how can you bring a 14-year-old to this? This lady's making love to a head, a severed head. What's wrong with you? I loved it. I think she was thinking more of the fact that it was a movie about a violinist, and it had an enormous amount of wonderful violin music in it, you know. And that's what I heard when I didn't even notice there was a love story. Not the first time I saw the movie. I think it was 10 years old. But I've seen the movie many different times in my life, and it's always meant something different.
What has it meant the last time you saw it?
Well, you know, the last time I saw it, I actually went and made this recording very soon after this bad period in my life. So, you know, you can imagine at the end of the movie, Joan Crawford commits suicide. Very dramatically, she walks into the Atlantic Ocean while he's playing Wagner at Carnegie Hall. It's so wonderful. Such a great movie. So I certainly could relate to different aspects of it at the latter point in my life.
It's kind of interesting that you recorded the music from this film, given all of the tumult of the last few years in your life.
I know, it's amazing. Actually, you know, the project came up, and I went, oh, my God, of course. And it's such great music, too. Just fantastic music. Franz Waxman did all of the transcriptions. And for a violinist to get to play solo Wagner, it's unheard of. He didn't write anything for the instrument except in an orchestra. So it was fantastic. The variety of music in this one CD, I play solo Bach and I play Cole Porter, you know, and I play Lalo and, you know, standard things, and I play Carmen and Wagner. It's wonderful.
Not just Salerno Sonnenberg, it's just been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg. She's the subject of a new film, Speaking in Strings. It's currently playing in theaters nationwide and airs on HBO in December. Her new CD is humoresque. Coming up, a review of the new Dixie Chicks CD. This is Fresh Air. The Dixie Chicks are the most popular act in country music right now, having sold over 5 million copies of their 1998 release, Wide Open Spaces. Most performers would try to replicate the sound of such a success, but rock critic Ken Tucker says the Dixie Chicks have been admirably adventuresome in their follow-up CD called Fly.
With a moniker like the Dixie Chicks, you pretty much know you have one strike going against you among rock and roll fans who hear such a name as either self-defined sexist, cornball, or both. Country music isn't known for its irony, which most of the time is a blessing. It gets its best effects from honest, forthright emotions. But these chicks, sisters Emily Robison, who plays the banjo, and Marty Seidel, who plays fiddle, plus guitarist Natalie Maines, who sings her brains out, they intend their name as a softened code word for tough chicks. They don't mess around, as when they sing with glee about offing a wife beater in Goodbye Earl.
Marianne and Wanda were the best of friends all through their high school days. Both members of the 4-H club, both active in the FFA. After graduation, Marianne went out looking for a bright new world. Wanda looked all around this town and all she found was Earl. Well, it wasn't 2 weeks after she got married that Wanda started getting abused. She put on dark glasses, long sleeve blouses, and makeup to cover her bruise. Well, she finally got the nerve to file for divorce. She let the law take it from there. But Earl walked right through that restraining order and put her in intensive care.
That song, a variation on Thelma and Louise, was written by Dennis Lindy, one of the many old pro country songwriters the Dixie Chicks employ on Fly. Lindy is also the author of Elvis Presley's last great hit, Burnin' Love. Goodbye Earl has, to my amusement and probably that of the Chicks, stirred some debate over the violence in its lyric. USA Today even went so far as to publish a long list of country songs dating back to the 50s in which bad spouses and innocent victims are gotten rid of, starting with Johnny Cash shooting a man in Reno, quote, just to watch him die. When country singers trill about murder, it's a troubling but titillating pop trend. When rappers do it, it's criticized as criminal behavior and a reason for banishment. This would be funny if it wasn't so racist. Anyway, good for the Chicks, who are also, I should point out, capable of much lighter moments. Dixie Chicks play into and out of stereotypes. All three are blonde, and I'm guessing at least one of them gets it out of a bottle. They like to wear skimpy outfits to freak out their elders at country awards ceremonies. And on their CD booklet, they use one definition of the title Fly to run a photo of the trio emerging from an open zipper in a giant pair of jeans. Fortunately, such silliness is complemented by some really good hardcore country music, such as this.
Hello! Mr. Heartache, I've been expecting you. Come in and wear your welcome out the way you always do. Never say if you're here to stay or only passing through. Hello, Mr. Heartache, I've been expecting you. When I
Singer Natalie Maines is the daughter of Lloyd Maines, whom the Joe Ely fans among you know played pedal steel guitar on Ely's best albums. Combine this background with the fact that the two sister chicks place their banjo and fiddle much higher in the mix than most country music productions, and you've got a small miracle, a crossover act that's truer to its roots than their hairdresser is.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Fly, the new CD by the Dixie Chicks. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Helen Wong. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
For the life of me, I can't believe that you're on begging, please, all the pushing away and putting down. Can't you see you're getting the run around? What was plain to see, you'd rescue me from my loneliness, so called unhappiness.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Dial Press, publisher of the Plutonium Files by Eileen Wilson, a look at America's secret medical experiments in the Cold War. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Nobody but you and me.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the seductive soul singer Barry White. Join us for the next Fresh Air.